inaccuracy errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss healthcare reform with Families USA Executive Director Ron Pollack, and later Congressman Chris Van Hollen will join us to discuss voter protection issues. But first, Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul joins us to discuss the latest monthly job figures. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Jason, great to be with you.
So, Scott, the latest monthly jobs report was released last week, with the U.S. gaining about 120,000 jobs in March, 37,000 of which were in the manufacturing sector. What's your reaction to those numbers?
Well, you know, overall, the number was was down a bit from February, but obviously still headed in the right direction, creating jobs. For manufacturing, it was March was a good month. 37,000 jobs created. We've seen a good resurgence in manufacturing jobs, not only this year but over the last couple of years since the beginning of 2010. And this is, I have to say, a welcome change for a sector that was completely decimated in the last decade, where there was just literally a bloodletting of manufacturing jobs almost every month. We lost an average of 40,000 manufacturing jobs a month that entire decade. So anything in the positive territory is welcome, but we obviously have a long way to go to make up for that lost decade we had.
Sure. Scott, in the recent months that have passed, how have manufacturing jobs stacked up with the overall amount of jobs that have been created? Is it comparable to what it was in March?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we have just since the beginning of this year, 2012, we've gained 120,000 manufacturing jobs. Since the beginning of 2010, we've gained 472,000 manufacturing jobs. And when you consider that, Jason, against the size of the overall employment picture, I mean, manufacturing is having an outsized gain in jobs compared to its size of the economy. It's a fairly small portion of the U.S. economy now. It's less than 12% of gross domestic product. It's well under 10% of employment. But we've seen in some months, like last month, for instance, manufacturing account for fully a third of the jobs gained. And so for a change, it is really in a lot of ways driving any sort of economic recovery that we've seen. Now, I will be very quick to add that we have a long way to go to seeing what I would call a healthy jobs recovery in the private sector, in the public sector, and overall. But I will say that it's important to have a strong manufacturing jobs recovery that will help to spill over into these other sectors as well.
Yeah, what does that say about the economy whenever the manufacturing sector is doing well?
Well, it says a couple of good things, and there are benefits for other sectors of the economy. Manufacturing jobs tend to pay a little better than jobs in the service sector. That means there's a little more discretionary income floating around. That obviously has a positive impact for retail, for services, for other sectors. When manufacturing jobs are up, and also when manufacturing enterprises are making profits, that is actually good news for revenues and therefore the public sector at the local, state, and federal levels. Although, again, that can take months to spill over and have that impact. But when you create a manufacturing job, you are supporting up to four or five other jobs in the economy, and they don't pop up all at once, but they do eventually sprout both directly and indirectly because of the type of activity that's involved with manufacturing. You have suppliers, you have logistics, and then you have slightly bigger paychecks that mean there's more money being spent at the grocery store, at the flower store shop, at the hardware store, et cetera. So that's it's good for Main Street, but it doesn't all happen right at once. It takes months for that kind of effect to happen.
Scott, you had noted earlier that the numbers from March were down a little bit from February. How concerned should we be about that?
Well, I think it's always dangerous to read into month-to-month changes in overall jobs. I think that's you'll drive yourself crazy doing that every month. Obviously, if you see a downward trend that lasts a few months, that is not a good thing. I mean, there are a couple things to note about this jobs report. First of all, you know, it was positive, 120,000 jobs overall gained in March. But that was down considerably from the number in February. A lot of economists are chalking that up to quite an odd seasonal effect because of the early spring, and some of the employment that you normally see coming on in spring for landscaping and other stuff started a month early because of the weather. And so instead of being sort of smoothed out, it was front-loaded in effect. But I obviously we'll know more over the next couple of months. I do think that we need smart policies to continue to grow jobs. I think that's critically important. But I don't, I heard a lot of hysterics on talk radio about how the recovery was stalling, et cetera, based on 1 month of jobs figures. And is 120,000 jobs created good enough? Actually, no, it's not, but it's headed in the right direction. And when you look at the first few months of the year, we do seem to be headed into that positive territory.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Scott Paul, the executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, you had mentioned about some policies to grow jobs in America. What are some policies that would spur job growth?
It's a good question, and there are a couple of things that I think we need to do that we still need to do as a country. One is investment, public investment, and that's obviously investment in education so that we have a skilled workforce. It's investment in infrastructure. We need to rebuild our infrastructure. It is not first class. In fact, it's not even second class in a lot of cases. We have a dilapidated and crumbling infrastructure. That would create construction jobs, some services jobs, and with Buy America laws, manufacturing jobs as well. We need to also make smart changes to tax policy so that we are rewarding both workers and enterprises that are actually creating jobs and producing in the United States. The president has proposed a suite of changes in his budget and State of the Union address. I think many of these are quite welcome, long overdue. I'm not holding my breath with what Congress is going to do for those, Jason, but I do think that they provide us with a good roadmap of how to proceed in the future. And then the other piece of this, and you know, there are a lot of other elements that go into this, obviously, but the other main piece of this is that we also have to create a level playing field for firms that are competing against foreign competition, and that means aggressively enforcing trade laws, going to bat for American workers, American businesses that are facing subsidized competition from China or unfair trade practices. I do think the administration has been getting more aggressive on that, but we obviously have a long way to go because we still have an enormous trade deficit with countries like China.
Scott, regarding policies, are you comfortable with how President Obama has attacked the jobs issue in trying to spur job growth?
Yeah, I think that I'm not president. I would like to see more, but I do think that the general thrust of the policies has been a good one. I think pushing to rebuild our infrastructure is a good policy. I think believing in manufacturing as a driver of economic growth is a good policy, and then having tax investment, innovation, education support to back that up, I think that is very good. there is obviously only a limited amount of stuff that the White House can do on its own. It can do some things, but it takes the cooperation of Congress. And there, I do think we have a ways to go. You know, there's an infrastructure bill that has been debated, deferred, delayed, and we simply can't afford to wait to rebuild our country. I think that's critically important. So could the White House be doing more? Sure, they could be doing more, but I think that, again, the thrust of the policies that the president is proposing do take us in the right direction for manufacturing.
Scott, and in terms of Republican presidential candidates who are seeking the nomination to battle President Obama, have you heard anything from them that makes you think one way or the other about potential job policies?
Well, it's a good question, and obviously we're pretty much down to the president, Mitt Romney, right now, barring anything that is incredibly unlikely and unforeseen. But I do think that there's one issue in particular. There's a couple of issues that deal with manufacturing that will be prominent in this presidential campaign. One issue dealing with the auto rescue, and the other dealing with China. And first on the auto rescue. Obviously, that was a very difficult thing that the administration did, providing loan guarantees to Chrysler, to General Motors. The UAW made a considerable number of concessions, but now we see an auto industry that is back on its feet, that is making great cars that people want to buy. It's profitable. It's sharing those profits with workers. They're actually bringing some work back to the United States. It has, I think, gone better than anyone imagined that it would go, and it's an aspect that Mitt Romney strongly opposed and said, let Detroit go bankrupt. And so I think that's issue number one. Issue number two is China. And there you see some back and forth. You see Mitt Romney saying that the president is not being aggressive enough with China on its currency policy, on opening its procurement market. You see the White House hitting back at Mitt Romney, saying that Mitt Romney opposed trade enforcement cases that have created jobs in the United States. So I actually, along with all the other issues that you can expect to see in the presidential campaign, I think these particular manufacturing issues are going to receive a very high profile moving forward.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our jobs discussion with Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number for MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Scott Paul, the Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, as far as manufacturing goes, what are some projects that could be started right now that would strengthen the country and boost manufacturing jobs?
Well, it's a great question, Jason. And let me talk about two different aspects that would be extraordinarily helpful. One is to continue to modernize our clean energy infrastructure and clean car infrastructure. And that means investments in solar, in wind, in biofuels, in advanced batteries, so that the United States can be a global leader. Because eventually, we will have a diverse energy supply, and rather than simply sourcing it from China or Germany, we need to build up that domestic capacity. And we invented these technologies a decade ago, but then we lost our lead because we had not a couple decades ago, but we lost our lead. And so we're playing catch up, and we shouldn't just trade foreign oil for foreign made solar and wind technology. So that's number one. Number two is on infrastructure. We actually have a number of governors who are being very aggressive about stepping up to the plate with infrastructure funds, wanting to rebuild bridges, build out their ports, and retrofit buildings. And those are tremendous opportunities if they're made in America. We saw a horrible decision just a few years ago that then Governor Schwarzenegger, made in California to outsource the steel in the Bay Bridge to China instead of having it made in the United States. The governor thought he could save money. It ends up that's not the case. The bridge is also behind schedule, and it cost about 2,500 manufacturing jobs in the United States. But you see governors like Governor Cuomo, you see Governor Brown, you see the state of Washington, you see Mayor Emanuel in Chicago, Mayor Villagrosa in Los Angeles stepping up and wanting to jumpstart infrastructure and transit. And we're all for that, but we also think that it should be made in America, those rail cars, that steel, and that's the way that you get a real value added for our economy, because you know that consumers and customers will enjoy the benefits of this infrastructure. You know that our construction workers will be working on it. You don't know where the material is made. That's why we have Buy America laws. And so as long as we have those strong Buy America laws, investing in infrastructure is a great deal for manufacturing as well.
So just talk for a minute about the importance of having a strong infrastructure. Sometimes I think that might get forgotten a little bit in some of the discussions that we have as a nation. How important is it to really build up the infrastructure of the country?
It's critically important for a couple of reasons. Number one, safety. We have not even dozens, but hundreds of bridges that are at the end of their useful lifespan and need to be replaced. So that's the primary concern. The second is obviously environmental concerns like relieving congestion, reducing commute times, et cetera, which is why you need to build out transit, why you may need to expand some highways, et cetera. And the third is the efficiency of our economy. And quite simply, unless we have the best and most modern seaports, airports, rail system, highway system, we will be falling behind our competitors who have all these logistics figured out. And the more efficient you can make our transportation system, the better that is for our overall economy and for the companies that are located here. It makes getting their goods and services to the people who need them so much easier. So those are, safety, environmental benefits, and economic efficiency are probably the three reasons why you want to build infrastructure. And infrastructure is a vague term, so let's define it. It's our roads, it's our bridges, it's our rails, it's our airports, our seaports, it's even our energy grid, and our sewers, our clean water systems. So there's a lot that goes into it. And in virtually all of these categories, Jason, America is it doesn't have an A, a B, or even a C, but according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, it has a D or a failing grade, which is completely unacceptable.
So what then do you think it will take to bring that letter grade up to a more acceptable level?
Well, it'll take a couple of things. Number one, it will take Congress passing a multi-year infrastructure bill to authorize these projects and authorize the money to do that. Number two, it will take some innovative financing, and the White House has proposed something called an infrastructure bank that would attract private sector investment for some of these projects. I think there should be a concern about making sure that these are public goods, that these are public roadways and bridges, and I do have a concern about that. But I do think that we need to find some innovative ways to finance these. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it involves the resources. It involves the money to do that. And you see a number of states have considered whether or not to do fuel tax increases or what have you to finance infrastructure. Mayor Emanuel recently announced a plan in Chicago just last week that doesn't increase taxes, but make savings in some other areas to promote infrastructure. But I think, you know, these smart mayors, smart governors, they realize we need to do this. The White House realizes we need to do this. Just need to get Congress to act, I think, and to act in a very responsible way.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Scott Paul, the executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, you and I have spoken many times about China and its role in the U.S. manufacturing discussion, particularly with its currency manipulation. What's the latest on that issue?
The latest is that China is still has an undervalued currency, which gives it a trade advantage, and it just works this way. U.S., because China's currency, the yuan, is undervalued compared to the U.S., and it's a result of Chinese government policy that it's that way. It makes our exports more expensive going into China, so we have less exports going into China. It makes Chinese imports coming to the United States cheaper than they otherwise should be, which means there are more imports, and it gets our trade balance out of whack, which costs us jobs, it costs us revenue, and it's ultimately unsustainable. Now, we have seen the value of the Chinese currency creep up a bit, but we've actually seen it level off over the last couple of months. And so most independent observers who look at it still think that we have a way to go. There are a couple of things that we can do. We can pass some legislation that would penalize China if it manipulates its currency. The Senate has done that, in fact, in a very bipartisan way last year. If Speaker Boehner would bring up China currency legislation in the House of Representatives, it would be very beneficial. Over 100 Republicans supported this bill the last time it came up in 2010. So I'm confident it would pass by an overwhelming margin because virtually all the Democrats support this bill. The White House could also name China as a currency manipulator, which would trigger a series of negotiations to eliminate China's currency manipulation as well. So there are some additional policy tools that we can use that we haven't so far. But I think that one of the biggest challenges facing manufacturing right now is this currency imbalance with China. Once we get that resolved, we can move on to some other things as well. But that's step one for me.
Scott, does this issue impact other countries as well when they deal with China, or is this unique just to the United States?
You know, it's a very good question, Jason, and it impacts other currencies as well. For instance, Mexico, Canada, who fate's very much tied to the United States, have serious concerns about China's currency policies. So does Germany and France. So does a country like South Africa. Other Asian competitors as well. So it's not a uniquely American concern with China. However, I will also say that the United States is the only country with the market power to actually compel China to change. And so everyone looks at the United States for leadership on this because China sends about one-third of its exports to the U.S. market, giving us a tremendous amount of market leverage when it comes to affecting this issue that other countries simply don't have.
Scott, a piece that you mentioned earlier that was interesting was a possibility that the White House could name China as a currency manipulator. Explain that a little bit.
Well, there is a process twice a year that was set up that requires the Treasury Department to submit a list of countries that are manipulating their currency in order to gain a trade advantage. And I will say that there has not been a country named since the 1990s, even though it's clear that some countries have been manipulating their currency, not only China, but some other countries as well. And the president, before he took office, indicated that he would indeed name China as a currency manipulator if they were in fact manipulating their currency. Thus far, the White House has avoided doing this. It's aggravating to me. It's aggravating to a number of industrial unions and to domestic manufacturers as well. And so it's in fact the president has even pretty much said China's manipulating its currency, but the Treasury Department has never filed this formal report. It will have an opportunity to do so just within the next couple of weeks. April 16th is the next deadline for submitting this report. However, I have to say, Jason, I'm not holding my breath based on what we've seen the last few years. But I think it would be an extraordinarily helpful gesture in putting more pressure on China to increase the value of its currency.
Yeah. Do you think that then the Chinese government would respond if the White House sent a strong message in that regard?
Well, that's been my experience, and it's interesting because some people say, oh, you don't want to publicly provoke China like this. But the challenge that I have is that when we've tried to work behind the scenes in a diplomatic fashion, China does just enough to avert any negative attention, but not enough to really change the playing field at all. And without that sort of public pressure, I think it's very challenging to make significant progress with China. And I think it's much better when you have economic powers like the United States and China, who are both want to cooperate on some issues and are very competitive on other issues. I think it's important to have an honest understanding about what the disagreements are. And China generally doesn't hesitate to let the United States know when it's unhappy with one of our policies. It will issue a veto at the United Nations Security Council. And it's unfortunate that we've been reluctant to sort of step up and say to China, we're unhappy with your economic policies. We're going on record with that. Now we expect you to do something about it now that you know how unhappy we are. And I think just having that honest discussion would actually help moving the ball forward, even though it would, you know, certainly initially prompt an outcry from China. But there's very little leverage that China has in this regard, just simply because of their dependency on the American market for so much of their employment.
Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here and appreciate all that you do to make sure your listeners are aware of what's happening in government. Appreciate it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll get the latest on healthcare reform with Families USA Executive Director Ron Pollack.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by Ron Pollack, the Executive Director of Families USA. Ron, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me again.
So today is a very significant day. Just steps away across the street at the United States Supreme Court, the justices will begin hearing arguments around the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that at the end of the day, actually the end of 3 days, I think the Affordable Care Act and all of its key provisions will be deemed constitutional. There are two key issues that probably get the most serious attention. One is whether this individual responsibility provision that requires someone to purchase insurance, or if they don't, if they can afford it, they have to buy it. If they can't afford it, they don't have to buy it. But if they can't afford it and they don't buy it, then they have to pay a tax penalty. And that's being challenged. Also, what's being challenged is expansion of the Medicaid program that's designed to help low-income people and families that currently are excluded from the Medicaid program. I think at the end of the day, those provisions are going to be upheld.
Talk a little bit about maybe where we are in history right now with this. This is a very significant event. The Supreme Court has decided to take 3 days to hear this, which is almost unprecedented. Talk a little bit about where we stand today on that.
Well, first of all, 3 days of argument has not happened since 1966. So that's rather significant. But remember, about 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt tried to get affordable, quality health coverage for everyone. And every president, or almost every president since that time, tried to do the same thing. Franklin Roosevelt tried, Harry Truman tried, John Kennedy tried, Lyndon Johnson tried, of course Bill Clinton tried, Richard Nixon even tried, and they all failed. They were all unable to get this passed. So President Obama did achieve this, and it is moving forward, but of course there was strong opposition from conservatives, particularly Republicans, and so if we pass, as I think we will, constitutional muster through the argument of the Supreme Court, I think this law is going to be implemented and implemented effectively all across the country.
When you look at the law, what is your favorite part of it?
Well, what I like most is that everybody who is legally in the country will be able to get access to coverage that is affordable. Middle-class families are going to get tax credit subsidies that will make health coverage affordable. Low-income people will be able to get coverage through the Medicaid program that is expanded. And so I really rejoice at the fact that finally almost everybody in the country who is legally in the country will be able to get health care coverage. Now, in addition to that, the insurance companies are now going to be regulated in a way that helps consumers. So they can't deny health care coverage due to a pre-existing condition, like a child who has asthma or diabetes. They can't charge women a discriminatory premium just because they might become pregnant at some point. They cannot place an artificial cap on how much they pay out when somebody has a catastrophic illness. They can't terminate you from health coverage when you get sick. Those are all protections that don't exist today. And so I think the most important thing to remember here is that people are now going to have security like they've never had before.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Ron Pollack, the Executive Director of Families USA. Ron, when you talk about families having something that they've never had before, this sense of security, how's that going to change the way that we live moving forward?
It's going to change us in a lot of different ways. You know, some people never switch jobs, even though they want to switch jobs, because they're afraid if they move to a different job, they're not going to get health care coverage. When family circumstances change, your spouse may be the person who, through whom you have health insurance. Well, if something happens in the marital relationship, you're afraid that you're going to lose your health care coverage. If you get sick, you're afraid that an insurance company is going to deny coverage to you or charge you an arm and leg that you can't afford. So in all these various situations, people will now have protections. People will continue to have access to affordable, quality health coverage. And that's like something we have never had before. So this is truly historic.
As we look forward to the rest of 2012, what will Families USA's top priority be?
Well, we have, I would say, three priorities. Number one, let's make sure that those who want to undermine this law, that they do not succeed in doing that. Number two, we want to make sure that the law gets implemented effectively in state after state. And third, we're now going to get to the agenda of health care costs, because health care costs have been rising enormously over the past decades. And so we're going to have to try to moderate health care costs so that they are affordable for all of us.
We knew that health care costs have been spiraling out of control. At the end of the day, if something isn't done, what's the end result there? What's the real danger of health care costs just ballooning beyond repair?
Well, it'll mean that more and more people will just be shut out of America's healthcare system. Today we have 50 million people who don't have healthcare coverage. And that number is only going to grow if the Affordable Care Act is undermined and healthcare costs continue to rise. So it's really important that we protect the Affordable Care Act. That gives us big improvements in terms of coverage. And we've got to go forward with the cost agenda so that the costs for workers, for employers, for government, that we get those under control.
Do you find that there's more acceptance and more buy-in to the health care law when people learn about it point by point, some of the things that it has to offer?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even the surveys that show that the American public is sort of evenly divided about the Affordable Care Act, when you ask them about the specific provisions in the statute, they overwhelmingly say those are good things. Now, they often don't know that it's in the statute, that it's in the reform law. As they find out about it, I think the support for the Affordable Care Act is really going to skyrocket.
What do you think the future holds for health care?
I think the future for health care is we're going to have many more people with health care coverage. I think we're going to emphasize preventive care, and I think now all the different stakeholders are going to try to work together to make sure that we moderate costs.
Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA, as always, thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss voter protection issues with Congressman Chris Van Hollen.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman Chris Van Hollen from Maryland. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Very good to be with you.
So as election season rapidly approaches, what are your thoughts on some of the issues around voter protection and voter rights?
Well, we've seen a concerted effort in many states to limit access to the ballot box. These are laws in search of a problem. The claim is you have a lot of in-person voter fraud where there's just no evidence of that. The real purpose here is to disenfranchise individuals, especially minorities, lower-income voters, seniors, and younger voters. And we need to fight back against this. This goes to the core of our democracy and the right to vote. There are also other efforts to try and scale back early voting and other measures that were designed to expand people's participation in our democracy, which is what we should all be striving for.
And why do you think that is, some of those efforts to limit the voting rights of certain parts of the population?
Well, I think it's a crass and very cynical political effort to try and influence the outcome of the elections by limiting participation in the elections. These laws are clearly aimed at limiting the participation of voting constituencies that come from, you know, lower income populations, minority populations, seniors, and younger voters. Historically, those voters, at least in recent times, have voted for Democrats, which is why you see this effort in many Republican-controlled states to try and limit this access to the ballot box. I'm pleased that the Justice Department has begun to take action in some of these cases, and I hope ultimately the courts will recognize this effort for what it is, an effort to limit the right to vote rather than focusing on expanding the right to vote and access to the ballot box.
Congressman, how much of an issue do you expect this to be leading up to the elections in November?
Well, this issue sort of takes on two aspects. One is the legal fight, and I think that will continue to heat up. There are cases making their way through the courts in a number of states right now. Then there's the political side of the equation, and I think it's very important that voters understand exactly what's at stake here, and it should make people very upset that there are efforts underway to deliberately restrict people's access to the ballot box, measures that are designed to curb early voting efforts, which have proven to expand participation, and these efforts to require very specific types of identification, types of identification that are less prevalent among certain parts of the population, which is why this effort clearly is designed to disenfranchise certain groups.
Congressman, at the end of the day, how important is it simply for every American to have an opportunity to vote?
Well, I think it's essential, and it obviously goes to the core of our democracy. I had the opportunity to grow up in many places overseas. My father was in the Foreign Service, and I lived in many countries where people did not have easy access to the ballot box. And one of the things they always respected about America was the idea that everybody has that right, the right to go out and vote. It's hard enough to get people in the United States to fully participate and exercise their rights. So we know that we don't have, you know, huge 100% turnout in election. So our problem really has been getting people to fully exercise their right to vote, and now we have this sort of fake issue of claims of fraudulent voting with virtually zero evidence to back it up. I mean, the reality is that people aren't going to risk going to prison for fraudulent voting. I mean, the penalties are huge here. As I said, it's hard enough to get people to go to the ballot box anyway. The notion that, you know, people are running to the ballot box to commit fraud is just absurd on its face.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman Chris Van Hollen. Congressman, not too long ago, House Republican leadership released their budget proposal for 2013. What's your reaction to that?
Well, this budget is way out of step with the core priorities and values of our country. And it takes a very lopsided approach. And what I mean by that is it seeks to address our deficit challenge by making significant cuts in very important areas for our economic growth. It dramatically cuts our investments in infrastructure, in science and research, in education, things that are going to be absolutely essential for the United States to compete in the global economy. Second, it shreds the social safety net. It starts the process of ending the Medicare guarantee, which would essentially mean that seniors no longer had the financial support from the Medicare program necessary to provide the coverage that they have today. It decimates Medicaid, a program that many seniors in nursing homes rely on, that disabled individuals rely on, that poor kids rely on. And at the same time, it provides even bigger tax breaks for millionaires and special interests. And so because they actually increase tax breaks for special interests, they deal with the deficit on the backs of everyone and everything else. So those tax breaks for the very wealthy come at the expense of the rest of the country. They come at the expense of the Medicare guarantee. They come at the expense of major investments needed to keep our economy strong first recover and then regain its strength. And that is a reflection of the priorities of this budget. In other words, tax breaks for millionaires first at the expense of everything else. And I don't think that's a budget that the American people would be proud of.
In your opinion, what's the best way to fix the budget deficit and also improve the country's infrastructure, maintain investments, as you had said, in science and education and some other key areas?
Well, we have to tackle the deficit. So the issue is not whether we address the deficit. It's how we address the deficit. And we need to make sure we keep in mind two things. First, we should do nothing to disrupt the ongoing but very fragile recovery. And that means maintaining important investments, say, in transportation. We have about 17% unemployment in the construction industry in the United States. And we have lots of important needs to be met, roads, bridges that are in disrepair, transit systems. And yet the Republican budget would cut our investment in transportation by almost half next year. A lot of projects that are currently that have been bid could actually be disrupted. So that will just harm the economy, and we need to make sure we don't do that. Second, as we reduce the deficit over the longer term, we need to take a balanced approach, meaning that we need to make some tough cuts, and we've already made over $1 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years through measures already enacted. But we also should do what every bipartisan group that's looked at this challenge has recommended, which is also to increase revenues by closing down tax loopholes for special interests, and we should ask folks at the very high end of the income scale to share greater responsibility. That's why it's important to enact the Buffett rule, named after Warren Buffett, who observed that he was paying a lower effective tax rate than his secretary and others who worked for him. That's just not fair. And if we're going to deal with our deficit, as we must, we have to do it in a balanced way, because if we don't ask, you know, millionaires to pitch in more, it means that everybody else gets hit even harder, whether it's folks on Medicare, Medicaid, or important investments for our kids.
When you think about some of the proposals that are made to cut some public services, what comes to your mind in terms of the impact to the American people?
Well, one of the things we've seen is the scapegoating of public servants, federal employees. We, of course, have seen this at the state level in states like Wisconsin, where the governor's gone after, you know, firefighters and school teachers. And we've seen a similar effort at the federal level to suggest that federal employees are somehow responsible for the economic mess that we got into in the, you know, 2007, 2008, which obviously doesn't square with the facts. And if you cut back on the services that are provided by federal employees, what it means is that folks who rely on their Social Security won't get their, you know, checks on time. The Medicare system would not be able to continue to run efficiently. And then, of course, you have the ongoing operations of the federal government, whether it's the FAA, flight, you know, making sure that flights land safely, food safety inspectors, the FBI, border security, nurses who care for our veterans in hospitals throughout the country. I mean, these are all of the kind of ongoing day-to-day services that are provided by hardworking federal public servants. And to go after them is really to go after the services that are provided for the American people day to day, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, you know, law enforcement, border security, or any of these other areas that are designed to, you know, protect consumers.
And as we sit here and talk about some of those significant positions and duties that federal employees take on, do you think that the American public really fully appreciates all of that work that's being done on their behalf?
Well, I think all of us need to do a better job explaining the services that are provided. You know, it's so easy for some people to scapegoat and rail against, you know, faceless bureaucrats as if, you know, these are people that are not providing services, when in fact the opposite is true. And people recognize it when they're at the local level. For example, if you're going to the Veterans Hospital, you know, they see these people caring for our veterans. But a lot of the work goes unseen. I mean, we sort of take for granted food safety until there's an outbreak. We take for granted many of the ongoing efforts and services provided by federal employees. Again, the processing of Social Security checks, the law enforcement provided by the FBI, many of the discoveries for treatments and cures to diseases are as a result of the research efforts done in places like the National Institutes of Health. And the spinoff and the benefits from those research efforts have been huge for our economy, as have the benefits of other investments that have been made at the federal level in areas of cutting-edge research, which companies have then gone on to commercialize and, you know, utilize for the greater good. So I think that all of us need to do a better job of sort of explaining what's going on day to day for the benefit of the country.
Congressman Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, we certainly appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests this week, Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul, Families USA Executive Director Ron Pollack, and Congressman Chris Van Hollen. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife.